ask for your appearances. And I'll call the case Jason O'Grady and others versus the Superior Court with a real party in interest as Apple Computer, Inc. Your appearances, please.
Your Honor, I'm supposed to petition Jason O'Grady and Alicia Petita, Casper James.
Very good.
Good morning, Your Honor. George Riley with David Everhart. We represent the real party in interest, Apple Computer.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honor. Craig Williams appearing on behalf of Amicus Curiae, Bear Flag League.
Bear Flag League?
Yes, Your Honor.
Craig Williams, is that it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
And Dan Bagatelle appearing on behalf of Amicus Curiae, Intel Corporation.
All right. Are there other persons here who wish to announce their appearance? That is to say, Amici, there is, you may do so. If not, we'll go on. I don't see anyone. Yesterday, the clerk of our court worked out a schedule in this case. And I just want to go over it and make sure that we all understand exactly what we're going to be doing today. The petitioner will be allowed 12 minutes to open. Bear Flag will follow with a five-minute presentation. Apple will follow with a 12-minute presentation, with Intel adding 5 minutes. The court then proposes to take a 20-minute recess. The purpose of this recess is to allow us to talk with one another about what you've said. We will return after that 20-minute period, and each side will be given 15 minutes. Now, I have not worked out. I do believe that O'Grady should be given an opportunity to close. In other words, the 15 minutes will only be to Apple and to O'Grady. But Mr. Upsall, would you wish to reserve any of the time that you have on the after the return for a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
How much?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, so it'll be 10 and 5. All right, very good. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. As Kurt Opsahl, as I said, I'm representing the petitioner journalists. The petitioner journalists are seeking a writ to reverse the trial court's erroneous ruling denying their motion for a protective order against discovery to themselves and their service providers. A protective order is proper for two main reasons. First, the Federal Stored Communications Act prohibits discovery for the contents of email communications to an email communications service provider. Second, the petitioner journalists are entitled to a constitutional privilege against the discovery of confidential source information and unpublished information under the Liberty of Speech Clause of the California Constitution and the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. The Stored Communications Act prohibition is necessary in order to effectuate the privileges to which the journalist may be entitled. A subpoena must go to the journalists themselves so they may assert their defenses. A service provider is simply not in a position to identify which emails are entitled to privilege and which are not.
Why do you call them petitioner journalists rather than petitioners? Just curious. Sounds a little like a bootstrap statement, but I just wonder.
Because they are journalists, Your Honor.
Okay.
And it is as journalists that they are entitled to the constitutional privilege.
Well, they're journalists by what definition?
Well, we have two unrebutted expert testimony from a professor at the Berkeley School of Journalism, and also by Dan Gilmore, a noted technology journalist in his own right, both of which have said that they are indeed journalists.
Is that status at issue here in the case a little bit?
Well, for purposes of the trial court's opinion, it assumed without deciding that the petitioners were indeed journalists.
Okay. Thank you.
The journalists have been providing daily news coverage about their beat, Apple Computer, for over a decade. They have.
The fact that this, journalists have a somewhat of an exclusive website that deals with basically a limited subject, and it's over the internet and not printed on paper. Does that any of that make any difference?
No, Your Honor. The press, in its historic connotation, has encompassed every manner of publication that provides a medium for information and expression.
Do you concede that Asteroid, the description of Asteroid, was a trade secret?
No, Your Honor. We believe that that is still in doubt, but even assuming for the purposes of argument that it was a trade secret, nevertheless, the trial court's decision was an error and needs to be reversed.
You say even if it was a trade secret, it was an error?
Yes.
Your position is that the trial court should not have ordered your client to disclose the identity or whoever it was that submitted this information to your client, because that would be covered by both the First Amendment, it would be pursuant to Shield Law, a number of other, and the Act itself. Is that your position?
So to be clear,
so even if it is a possible violation of some trade law, would it make any difference?
First of all, under the Stored Communication Act, it makes no difference whether it was or was not a trade secret for the proposition that a subpoena to the email service provider was not proper and then instead...
If somebody took... And let's say someone inside Apple sent a copy of whatever this thing is and mailed it to your client, and your client published that. Would that person have a right, or would Apple or anybody else have a right to find out who mailed that document?
Apple absolutely has a right to conduct discovery. The question is whether they can shortcut through discovery and go directly to the journalists, as opposed to doing a discovery on their own employee suspects. They have found a group of 25 individuals who had access to the information at issue, and they have deposed none of them. And this goes to the exhaustion test under the Mitchell standard. And the Mitchell court and many other courts have determined that exhaustion is necessary, that going to the journalist has to be a last resort when all other options have been exhausted. But Apple has not exhausted other options. They have not conducted depositions of the employees. They have not done a forensic investigation of the employees' office computers.
Even if they had done all of that, what difference does that make? Assume that they did everything you just said and they still don't have the identity of whoever this person is disclosing this information. Does that permit the First Amendment to yield to Apple's interest in maintaining some confidentiality about a gadget that they have?
Well, the Mitchell test is a five-part test. So there are other factors that would tend against the disclosure, that exhaustion is a necessary component. Apple must exhaust. But if they have exhausted, that only means that you need to balance the remaining factors.
Does Mitchell deal with an issue like this?
Well, Mitchell dealt with determining confidential source information regarding some stories about the Sandian Church that were allegedly defamatory. It dealt with defamation, which is a little bit different from the allegations underlying this case of that the Does, presumably Apple employees, who have allegedly leaked this information.
Well, I would think it makes a huge difference, defamation actions compared to this. I mean, is it your position that Mitchell is applicable to your case?
Absolutely. Mitchell is a test by which the Supreme Court has set forth a balancing that is necessary to see when the qualified privilege under the Liberty of Speech Clause and the First Amendment should yield to the litigant's interest in providing this information.
And the strongest position you have on that is that they haven't exhausted their investigative responsibilities in this.
That is where they most obviously have failed. In addition, there are other factors. The petitioners are not parties to this litigation. That's the first factor. The discovery goes beyond the heart of the claim and claims that everything about Asteroid is a trade secret, including the name, when it's hard to see any commercial advantage Apple has in, say, naming it Asteroid over Meteor. Apple, as we said, had not exhausted all alternative sources. That's the third factor. The articles were concerning newsworthy information. That is the fourth factor. Though that fourth factor is actually a safety valve, it can only tend towards not disclosing the information. And finally, there is no prima facie claim against the petitioners. The trial court found there was a prima facie claim, but against the Does.
Could I just ask you a question? Apple is claiming that, this is as to the SCA, that the subpoena here falls within an exception for disclosures that, I'm going to quote from the brief, may be necessarily incident to the protection of the rights or property of the provider of that service. Meet that argument, please.
Very good. So the provider exception originated as a common law provision out of, there has a statutory scheme, 47 U.S.C. 605 under the Communications Act, and judges developed a common law exception for fraud, for providers investigating their own fraud. That was codified into the Wiretap Act, Title III, to the Omnibus Crime Control Act of 1968, when that became the law for the Wiretap Act and created the provider exception, again, for the purpose of allowing the provider to investigate fraudulent billing practices or fraud against their billing practices. In 1986, when the Stored Communication Act was enacted, they adopted the provision, the provider exception, from the Wiretap Act, again, for the purpose of combating fraud. Apple's interpretation renders a lot of things nonsensical. For records pertaining to a subscriber other than content of communications, the Stored Communication Act 2702 provides that the provider can give it to any person other than the government. There is no such corresponding provision in for content of communications. And if the provider exception was to be understood as to allowing responses in any case where a subpoena was at issue, then it would have no need to say that they could provide it to people other than the government.
I have another question for you. It's a slightly different one, but I'm looking at our clock here. You have a couple of minutes left. We've taken some of your time, I think. Is that all right?
That's all right, Your Honor.
Good. Can I ask you, let's suppose that PowerPage has a discussion board after a story. Would the contents of the discussion board, you with me on discussion board?
Yes, of course.
Would the contents of the discussion board enjoy the same protection, in your view, as the story in PowerPage?
The contents of the discussion board, they are published information, so the actual information that is published up on the website is not confidential, it is published information. And Apple doesn't even need discovery, it can get it directly from the...
No. I want to know whether you think that the protection that you're claiming for PowerPage would extend to something like a chat room or a discussion board or whatever that would... that often, not always, accompanies these stories.
Well, I believe that the protection for confidential sources is for information which is under the Sherman test. It is where there is an intent to publish the information at the beginning of the news gathering process, something which was clearly the case with respect to the information about Asteroid that was in the main story.
Well, is a chat room come within a definition of a news gathering source, or would it be? I mean, is that what you're getting at here? If the reporter's out there looking for a story, you want that person protected, whether it's published in the newspaper or on the web. But what about these ancillary things that happen after the publication?
I believe that there is a distinction that can be drawn. That there is the article itself and the information in that article, which is the information that we claim is protected, the confidential sources used to create the articles that are at issue here. In addition, you would have discussion boards where other people have submitted things, and that would fall into a different category.
Yeah, what category would that be in?
Well, that would be in terms of Which, in terms of the identity of sources?
Well, let me give you my example. You don't have much time left. Let's suppose that PowerPage conducts a discussion board after they publish the story about, using your terms, publish the story about Asteroid, and somebody types in, I'm an Apple employee, and I know that this what this thing is, and you've got the rendering wrong, and it's not blue, it's white, and of course it has an Apple logo on it. Now, in that instance, would that be what some of you have called posting?
Well,
Apple wants to say that its employees posted. Do they not?
Well, I don't. I think Apple would be best positioned to ask what their argument is.
But you've read their brief.
I read their brief. I do not think that they are saying that this information was posted to a discussion board.
Well,
however, go ahead. In a case where the information had been posted to a discussion board, then Apple is entitled to seek discovery of the identity of the information. But that would be a counterweight against the right to speak anonymously, and many courts have addressed
this. But you would concede that the subpoena would lie to find out who that person was that actually wrote something on the discussion board. Would you concede that?
The subpoena would lie towards identifying the person who wrote on the discussion board as opposed to a source for a story that was published.
May I ask one question there? What is the difference between, let's assume that there are letters to the editor of a newspaper, and the editor decides that he or she will not disclose the identity of the person sending the letter. Does that mean that if someone wants to know who this person is, they have a right to subpoena the editor of the newspaper to discover whether or not, to discover the name or identity of this individual? What's the difference?
Well, as the individual has a right to speak anonymously, that is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution, and that right is balanced against the need of a litigant to obtain that information.
So in this chat room, whatever they call this, let's assume that people are sending basically, effectively, it's like the letters to the editor, saying we read the story, we either disagreed, isn't that all still protected?
So it is protected by the First Amendment right to speak anonymously.
So there's no obligation on the part, I would presume, of the editor or the newspaper to disclose the identity of these people listing, responding to an article that the webpage publishes as a letter to the editor or...
So for the identity of the author of a letter to the editor, or for that matter, the author of a posting on a message board, in that case, the board itself or the newspaper in which the letter appears is not obligated to provide that.
Because the newspaper or this web page effectively exercises some sort of editorial discretion in allowing certain things to be posted, others not. So wouldn't that all be protected under the First Amendment and the Shield? Paul?
And the Shield, and for that matter, for a website where they have published information coming from a third party, it's also protected by the Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, 47 U.S.C. 230.
You know your time, so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Bear Flag.
May it please the Court, Craig Williams appearing on behalf of the Bear Flag League. I serve a couple of perhaps interesting functions. I am a lawyer and myself a blogger, and I'm a transition point between O'Grady and Apple because Bear Flag League takes the position on both sides of this argument. We believe that the situation that O'Grady presents is not ripe for this court's adjudication, and we also believe that Apple is correct in the sense that it's not ripe. We also believe and support O'Grady in the standpoint that bloggers are journalists.
You agree on the last question, and maybe this is not what you wanted to talk about, but the person who sends in a message anonymously commenting on the original publication or published information, is that person also come within the protection for the so-called journalist?
To the extent that it's a comment or a within the ambit, as Justice Elia, mentioned, it is a letter to the editor, and in the sense that that a person who writes into the newspaper anonymously can be expected to maintain that anonymous stature. The same is true on the internet. It's just simply taking the application of a print medium and putting it into an electronic medium.
So do you apply the publisher's protection to that person?
You do, because the publisher, like in the newspaper, has the option to allow or disallow that particular comment or control of the message board, and therefore control of the content, and there's some exercise of discretion. A chat room, as Justice Rushing was mentioning, or discussion board, is quite a bit like this courtroom in the sense that we are all commenting about an outside activity, but it is a common exchange between peers or people of ideas and a free expression. So that is protected, but it's protected on a different standpoint. A chat room or a discussion board is not necessarily regulated as part of a publishing news gathering effort. Chat rooms are set up by Yahoo or set up by other internet service providers to provide people the opportunity to use their services. And they
newspapers have chat rooms and discussion boards.
Well, they do. And in fact, newspapers are on electronic media, and that's free-ranging. And in fact, there is an example in Los Angeles where the newspaper allowed comments. The Los Angeles Times allowed comments to its site, and they got so obscene and obnoxious that the newspaper took it down. So there was discretion that was exercised on that. The discretion that's exercised on chat boards and discussion boards, or chat rooms and discussion boards, is quite a bit different. It may be regulated by one individual who seeks to purport to have knowledge about that particular area, but a chat room is very distinct from a publishing and news-gathering effort.
Okay. Why do you say that in this case is not ripe for decision?
Well, the court published an opinion 2 days ago, and I'm aware of the prescript against mentioning cases that were not discussed or briefed. But this case, obviously, since it was published 2 days ago, could not have been briefed, Matrix Initiatives. And in that situation...
Our court?
Yes.
What's the name of this case?
Matrix Initiatives. It was written...
We do have different panels.
Yes, I know. Just tell you wrote it.
And we don't read them all either. So.
And I appreciate that.
Especially you don't read mine.
And I don't have a citation to offer the court because it's on your website, which is where I found it.
That's pretty good.
But in that case, there was an anonymous... discovery was directed, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but it was directed toward an anonymous individual, and the court elected to say that it was not right because the discovery was directed to a non-party and to anonymous individuals. Here we have not known individuals, Mr. O'Grady and the other people that did the publishing, but we don't have parties. And that's the basis that Bear Flag League doesn't think that this case is exactly ripe yet for this court's adjudication. We think that it would be wise because this is simply the other side of the coin for Matrix.
So what happens if we let the subpoena, if that's the way we're going to go, let it proceed and they can continue discovery? Violate possibly somebody's constitutional rights? And I mean, what choice does this court really have at this point?
It is a Hobson's choice.
Exactly. So if we do nothing, the trial court's order goes into effect and could do some substantial damage.
Yes.
Or we have to take some action to make sure that it's correct.
Or the court could take a middle ground. It could take a third option and say that this is not ripe, but yet provide some instructions and some protection.
Some advice.
Some advice to the... well, you do that once in a while.
That's what my children say about me, that I'm an advice machine, but I'm not supposed to do it as a judge.
And I appreciate that, but the court can give some instructions on the point that is created by the Hobson's choice. I mean, if you decide that it is not ripe, there is a risk of violating the journalist's First Amendment rights. So the court could say it's not something that we believe is ripe for us to decide, but there are some discovery issues apart from the First Amendment issues that deserve the court's attention. The court can provide instruction on the discovery issues, perhaps in camera inspections, perhaps other protections that would satisfy the First Amendment rights on the discovery issues and yet leave the First Amendment issue untouched as unripe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Was that Sixth District case published or unpublished?
It was published. I have a copy of it.
Oh, that's right. I just wanted to know that. Thank you.
Mr. Riley.
May it please the Court. I'm George Riley. I represent Apple. 16 months ago, Apple suffered a very serious theft. The entire specifications, plans, and confidential renderings for an unreleased product were stolen from Apple and posted without editorial content on a website. Apple launched an immediate investigation.
Editorial content meaning what?
This wasn't a whispered tip about a new product. This was a wholesale reproduction of confidential plans and materials.
Yes, and?
Without any sort of editorial content.
What difference does that make?
I don't think it makes any difference because the key here...
Somebody is, whoever's printing that information or publishing it, has made some sort of editorial weighing when he or she publishes that information. I mean, the fact that if they take it verbatim and publish it, they exercise their own judgment to do that. So that, in effect, is an editorial sort of approach to the process.
And in so doing, violated Apple's rights to maintain its confidential information as confidential. I mean, it is clear from the United States Supreme Court down that companies have a right to maintain their trade secrets as trade secrets. And this action violated those rights of Apple.
Mr. Riley, we thought you would say that. Let me ask you a question. Had there been a defendant named in this case, that defendant would have had the right to ask Apple under 2019.210, used to be called 2019D, which was a lot easier to say, and that would have required Apple, that is to say, the party alleging the misappropriation of the trade secret shall identify the trade secret with reasonable particularity. That's not done here. Is that correct?
No, indeed, we did identify it with reasonable particularity.
Well, that demand was never made on you. Am I correct about that?
The defendant is anonymous, a John Doe, but the Superior Court required that Apple specify what the trade secrets were and required that the subpoenas be narrowly tailored to the identification of who took the trade secrets and specifically identified those trade secrets.
But you're only talking about when we speak of trade secrets here, it is that which was published on PowerPage and the other sites. Am I correct about that?
That is correct. The particular plans, the specifications, the confidential renderings, all of which was marked eyes only, highly confidential.
Okay, so we have a real Apple confidential slide. We have a copy of that, which is the second thing. And then the third thing is a concept drawing from Bob Borries. And number four is an artist's rendition by Paul Skates. Are three and four trade secrets?
Yes, because they were, and if you compare the images...
Claim they are trade secrets?
Yes. They were drawn...
You make that claim?
Yes, we do. And they were drawn directly from the confidential slides that were stolen from Apple Computer.
Have you asked to take Borries and Skates' deposition?
The petitioners in this case have said that their work and information would be outside the...
The answer is no.
No, we haven't, because it would be outside. But we did do a very thorough... In fact, our investigation exceeded those required by other courts in balancing First Amendment rights against the rights of a victim to discover the nature of the theft.
What investigation are you referring to?
The investigation that Apple conducted.
Well, none of that was under oath. It was anybody at Apple put under oath? You know, they were told, if you disclose this information, you'll be fired. So please tell us, did you disclose the information? Was there anything under oath? Did they testify effectively under oath?
No, we did not take the depositions, but we're not required to take the depositions.
Well, you're required to do a proper investigation before you go and say, hey, to the newspaper, give us all your sources. you should do something, such as put your employees under oath so that they, if they testify falsely, they can be prosecuted.
But, Your Honor, the cases do not require that we place...
They may not require, but it does not show that this is a legitimate, in-depth investigation. Simply calling 25 people in a court in a room and saying that you give this secret information to this person and they say no, I mean, that's not an investigation.
Your Honor, we did much more than that, if I may. We investigated all computer access to the secure server.
What is this secret anyway? What is this? Why would this be? I know you cited the Bunnell case. That was a completely different situation, if you recall. There, the information that they were trying to disclose was the detailed mechanism on how something works. Here, it's just a picture of a product that's going to plug into the Apple's own product. I'm having difficulty understanding why that in itself would be a trade secret.
Your Honor, that was not all. It wasn't simply a picture. There were detailed technical specifications, including information about how
it
operates.
Right, and so I would be able to go and produce this product based on that technical detailed information, like where it is?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you don't really claim that this was some kind of new technology, do you? I don't think your brief says that. I mean, this is plugging a guitar into a computer.
Judge Rushing, this was an entirely new product for Apple, which involves both software, hardware, as well as a number of different inputs. It was a product that Apple had never marketed before.
But many others had for at least 15 years.
Other companies had done similar products. Apple had never done this product. And this product offered new functionality that no other competitor offered. All companies protect these kinds
of
products.
Well, that certainly wasn't in the stories that ran in the blogs.
Your Honor, what...
So you're adding something new here, are you not?
No, not at all.
I have another question for you that's more important. I want to know... If those 25 people at Apple were on a network...
Yes, they were.
Is there a network log?
We checked both the network log...
Did you tell us that?
Yes.
Is that in your declaration? I don't see it.
It's in Robin Zonick's declaration, Your Honor. The server logs were checked.
Now, can you tell me if that network is capable of telling when... a CD is made, or a file is copied, or something is sent. Could it tell that?
It can tell you who logged in, who had access, when they had access. And in addition, when I was trying to describe the thoroughness of the investigation, we also checked Apple's emails. So in other words, we checked not only the server where the confidential material was located to determine access, we also looked at Apple's email servers to determine whether any of these 25 employees emailed these confidential materials outside of the company.
One of the things that you do not tell us in your declaration is how this slide stack was delivered to the 25 Apple employees. I mean, was that an email?
It was there.
Or was it hand-delivered? Did somebody send a letter to Apple that carried it over?
No, they had electronic access through the server. And
but you didn't tell us. Why didn't you tell us all these details about the log-in, log-out part? I mean, is that itself kind of something that you don't want to lay out?
Your Honor, in both the investigators that we had, Al Ortiz and Robin Zonick, summarized the investigation. And the Superior Court found that this was a thorough investigation that had exhausted the alternatives. Now, if you can compare that, for example, to Rodney Dangerfield's case, Editorial Star, what did he do? He interviewed 15 employees at the hotel. He checked with every available source, and the court permitted him, at that point, to go to the defendant journalist. We did far more than that over a two-year period.
I have a question for you under the Stored Communications Act. Under what possible legal scenario would you suggest that the email provider, the company, Kraft, would have any obligation to give you that information?
Under Section 2707. 2707 says that under a court order or statutory authorization, this material can be provided.
Well, if the court order is bogus, it doesn't have any validity in law.
But this court order clearly did have validity in law.
Well, that's why we're here.
But if it was an invalid order, if it was secured by fraud, for example, which is the Theofel case. In that case, there was a subpoena that was fraudulent on its face. And the Ninth Circuit said, you cannot serve a fraudulent subpoena and expect to give stored communications. But in that case, Your Honor, if that subpoena had been a valid, narrowly drawn subpoena, it is clear that the information would have to be provided.
Well, what if they disagree with the legal ruling?
They have an opportunity, as they have here, to contest.
They disclose the information and then contest it on appeal?
No, what they can do, which is what they've done here, Your Honor, and we agreed, we stayed the execution of the subpoena so they could test the validity of the court order here. So they have protections which are accorded all civil agents.
I understand all of that, but I'm just looking to the substance of it. What legal basis? You're saying because a court orders a subpoena, then you have to comply and so forth. But I'm saying, what is the legal basis for issuing a subpoena like that or to these people? What?
1710 of the California Code of Civil Procedure gives litigants the rights to discover all relevant information. And, Your Honor, there is an unbroken series of cases dealing with privacy statutes which permit courts to order subpoenas, to order production of documents, inspection, entry on to property, financial records.
But there's nothing expressed in the SCA. You're not claiming that. You don't claim it in your brief. There's nothing expressed in the SCA that gives that allows for a civil subpoena. Your argument is by implication. You're not claiming it. I mean, unless I'm totally wrong in reading your brief here, but you're not claiming any express right under the SCA. Am I correct?
Section 2707 says, subject to a court order or statutory authorization. And, Your Honor, if I may, there is two important cases on this. One is the IGC case from the Northern District of California, Judge Chin, and the other is an Eighth Circuit case, In Re Unsealing Surveillance Information. And what those cases stand for the proposition is, if Congress wants to foreclose the basic rights of civil litigants to obtain relevant information, they must do so expressly. There are dozens of statutes that create broad privacy rights against government intrusion. Those statutes have been held to permit proper civil discovery pursuant to the rights that all civil litigants have to discover relevant information.
All right.
And in the 350 pages of legislative history on this act, and the act was amended this year, Congress never intimated that it was going to supplant all of the rights that the states have put in place for civil litigants to discover relevant information. That would violate principles of federalism for Congress to abridge the discovery rights of civil litigants. And if it did so, it would have to do so expressly. The Companion Act here, the Electronic Surveillance Act, has been held to permit civil discovery because Congress didn't prohibit it. Our financial records, our bank records, our health records are all private. We have a constitutional right of privacy. But the courts have held in every instance that civil discovery can go forward subject to the protections accorded civil litigants.
Could I ask a question, Mr. Riley? It's a slightly different subject. We only have a couple of minutes left. Would you concede that if the petitioners were not, as you characterize them, engaged in trade secret misappropriation, the shield law would apply in the case? Will you concede that?
It would apply to a contempt threat. It only applies to contempt. The California shield law is very clear, only applies where there is a motion to hold a journalist in contempt. That is not what this case is about.
Would it make any difference, by the way, if this text appeared in the New York Times or the San Jose Mercury News?
If exactly what was printed appeared in a mainstream journal, no, it would not make any difference.
Any journal. So you could serve a subpoena on the Mercury News and ask them for their sources. That's your view, right?
Regardless of the nature of the media, if we satisfy the Mitchell test, because the Mitchell test has been applied to all forms of mainstream media, we are entitled to that information. That is as recently as the Miller case, where you have grand juries seeking identification of sources and information. The courts have uniformly held, if you satisfy the Mitchell factors, which we clearly have here, you're entitled to the information to recover our stolen property and to identify who stole it. That is all we are seeking in this case.
Does the your trade secret, let's say that you've got the trade secret complication, you've got the First Amendment complication, the freedom of press. Do you think that when these two are put on the same basic level, one should take precedence over the other?
Where they are,
so which would you suggest?
Where they are on the same level, the courts have engaged in a balancing test, and
yes,
that balancing test is Mitchell. It is our position, and the Supreme Court, in a case called Bartnicki, backs us up, is that where you are talking about the wholesale theft of trade secrets, there is no First Amendment implication. But even if there was a First Amendment implication, Mitchell provides the direction, which is a balancing test. And this is our...
In this case, the balance is weighing in what's... Obviously, you're going to say on your side. Right?
Yes, Your Honor, we satisfied all five of the tests, as the Superior Court found. This evidence is absolutely critical to the apprehension of the person who engaged in this criminal conduct. This is the only source that we have available for us. And, Your Honor, Infox contacted us and said, I have the evidence of criminal behavior here.
Yeah, we know that.
And we issued a subpoena for that information. We did this all entirely above board.
Mr. Riley, your time is up, and we have to hear from Intel.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. May it please the Court, Dan Bagatelle on behalf of Intel. Thank you first for permitting us to participate this morning. Intel believes that this case involves a balance of important interests on both sides, and I'd like to explain why Intel ultimately sides with Apple on these facts.
Can I ask you, all trade secrets are not equal, are they? For example, the release date of a sports drink, there's a case holding that's a trade secret, is a little bit different than the source code for your next chip.
There are indeed multiple kinds of trade secrets.
For example, Mr. Riley, I didn't mean to pick on Mr. Riley here, but he said there was a wholesale theft. I gather that wholesale might mean something like the entire ability to reproduce the document or the product because you have a set of plans and the like. Do you see any distinction between the kind of trade secrets involved here and other trade secrets? I'll give you an example. In 1986, I tried a case where Intel claimed that somebody had stolen its 386 math coprocessor and sold it to a competitor who made it and then competed with... Do you remember that case? You probably don't remember that case. You probably heard about that case. Mm-hmm. Would you see any difference between this trade secret claim and that one?
Not in this respect, Your Honor. The kinds of trade secrets at issue here are core, important trade secrets. They are in both technological trade secrets and commercial trade secrets. And the trade secrets that are involved with unannounced products are some of the most important that exist in Silicon Valley. If Intel, for example, were to have its design for its next generation of processor taken by somebody else, a competitor could copy that design. A competitor might not be able to do the exact design because we might have patent protection. Nevertheless, they could counter that design. Moreover, they would know exactly when and what type of chip we're planning to bring in the marketplace.
But
and they could counter that.
We're not talking about a competitor having stolen your latest secret. We're talking about something that's being published in a newspaper. And the source of the problem is the personnel process in that corporation. Why should the courts be involved in effectively taking over your personnel operations to make sure that everybody that you hire is acting properly within guidelines of ethics that the corporation requires? We're talking about something very important here. It's not the newspaper that's going to be copying your product. They simply are publishing the latest depiction of this thing, and that's it. So why should the First Amendment yield to your interest under these circumstances?
First of all, Intel fully recognizes the important countervailing interests of the media.
But it doesn't seem to support. I know they recognize it, but they then just discard it.
No, I don't think that's the case, Your Honor.
In the interest of making another machine.
No, I think what's the key issue here is the Mitchell five-factor test. And we support the qualified privilege that the Mitchell court announced. The question is, under that five-factor test, which interest is more important? And we submit that the important fact in this case that differentiates it from other cases is that the petitioners themselves were involved in the public disclosure of the trade secrets. The interests of the media are at their peak, of course, when they are essentially reporting on wrongdoing by others. It's a completely different situation, though, when a media outlet is actually the conduit for publishing the trade secrets themselves. They're actually a part of the tort, wittingly or unwittingly. We don't know in this case, for example, whether Mr. O'Grady asked for the information or was simply a conduit from somebody else. Nevertheless, we do know that he was the vehicle by which that trade secret information was released. And I agree with
your
honor.
Newspapers are always, television news are always the vehicles by which information is released. Some of it is very damaging. Some of it may imply possible wrongdoing, but that doesn't mean that you discard the protections provided by the First Amendment to press to protect, to be civilized and polite and not steal.
Oh, it's not an automatic disclosure, Your Honor. The five-factor test of Mitchell applies.
Well, you're talking about the five-factor. What is the weakest link in that five-factor, do you think, that you have in your case?
Well, Your Honor, it's Apple's case, not Intel's case.
You're arguing.
But I think the question that Your Honor has gone to is whether they took reasonable efforts to obtain the information from other sources, because that's certainly a part of the Mitchell test.
And you would agree they did not, I presume.
I would agree that they did take reasonable efforts in the context of this case.
Well, you say in your brief that you don't think that Apple needs to be disruptive or tough on its employees when searching for... Well, you say that.
Oh, no, Your Honor. I think they were disruptive and tough on their employees.
But you don't think they have to be. Well, you don't think they should be. You're allowed to take a kind of softer approach and say to them, did you disclose my trade secret?
No. Excuse me, not at all, Your Honor. We think that they took very significant efforts. Not only did they do the forensic investigation, but they interrogated all the employees under penalty of being fired. What we don't think they need to do is go the next step and actually take formal depositions of them. We don't think that's a step that's required under the case law or that's particularly pragmatic. The point is, when a victim has tried internally to find out the source of a leak and has failed at that, they got to be allowed to go outside and trace the flow of information backwards from where it comes from.
You know, I'm going to apologize to you. I confused your brief with that of Genentech. But let me read this quote from the Genentech brief. Apple should be excused from conducting a needlessly disruptive and demoralizing internal investigation. What do you think of that?
Well, that may overstate.
I mean, who excuses them?
No, I believe, Your Honor, that Mitchell makes clear you have to make reasonable efforts. That's not all conceivable efforts, but it's reasonable efforts. And if that means that you have to put the employees on the spot and ask them, investigate, interrogate, absolutely. We believe you need to do that. What we don't think you need to do is go the next step and call in a court reporter, because these are your own employees. You can compel them to attend, and you can punish them.
I know a little bit about your company. It's all outdated because it's been so many years since I tried one of your cases, but you have network logs at your company, I believe, and I think you could tell just about when anybody does anything.
That may exaggerate it slightly, Your Honor, but we do forensic investigations, and we have caught.
But you would be able to tell, for example, when a workstation transmitted this slide stack to somebody else. Wouldn't you be able to tell that?
Not necessarily. In some instances, yes. In some instances, no. And, Your Honor, I certainly can't answer for Apple in this case, but that would be part of the due diligence that would be required.
But see, it wouldn't just be Apple's habits in this. It would be the industry's attempt to reasonably protect its secrets that would provide the guidance to a court in determining whether or not they have taken measures to protect the secret.
I think there are two separate issues there, Your Honor. First is the issue of whether they've taken reasonable efforts so that the information constitutes a trade secret. And I don't think there's much of an issue here that they took reasonable efforts to do that. I don't think that you look at what everybody in the industry is doing or is
capable of doing or what Intel is capable of doing to determine whether they've taken reasonable efforts to track down the source of a leak. Really, you've got to look at what they have available to them and whether they've taken reasonable efforts to monitor that information, to track it down. I don't think you can ask them to do the impossible. Otherwise, you'd be setting the standard of Intel for the rest of all industry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, you were kind enough to agree to allow us 20 minutes to talk. We may take more or less time. I'm not sure. We don't know. But will you stay around? And we'll be back. We'll be back to hear the rest of your argument. Strumsell, you've reserved 10 minutes and then 5. You may proceed.
Thank you.
First, I would like to turn to the Stored Communications Act. Apple noted that Congress, in their view, needed to expressly prohibit the disclosure of the contents of communications.
You say Apple said that?
In their argument, said if Congress wanted to prohibit the disclosure of information, it needed to do so expressly. And indeed, Congress did so expressly in Section 2702A1, where it says that an email communication service provider, quote, shall not knowingly divulge to any person the contents of communications. Second, turning to 2707, this is not an authorization. This is a defense to a civil action that O'Grady may have against NFOX. And moreover, within the text of 2707, at the relevant point, it mentions in particularity a grand jury subpoena, but not a civil discovery subpoena. If Congress had meant that 2707 would encompass different types of subpoenas, it makes little sense for them to mention grand jury subpoena by name and not others. And this analysis is confirmed by FTC versus Netscape, which noted that if, in the context of 2703, that if Congress had meant to say civil discovery subpoenas instead of grand jury subpoenas, or in addition to
Congress not permits, I guess is your question, why would Congress not permit a civil subpoena? The reason behind that
is to ensure that people are not sacrificing their rights by taking advantage of third-party service providers to enjoy the benefits of the modern era. By allowing the subpoena, or requiring the subpoena to go to the account holder can raise privileges that they may have. The service provider would have no way of knowing which email messages come from the attorney.
If I telephone your client and I give him or her some so-called trade secret information, if they were to subpoena the telephone company, which they could sort of civil subpoena, there'd be nothing in that except that a phone call was made, because the phone company can't record any of that. So why should the internet, the email, be treated any differently? Is that basically...
Well, because they have the contents of the communication, right?
And email. So Congress wants to treat communication the same. If I'm using a telephone, I would not expect what I'm saying to be divulged, and if I want to use the email, I should have the same privilege. Otherwise, I will stop using the email system and stick with the telephone, which has ramifications economically and...
Indeed, that's exactly Congress's intent. And the email service provider would have no way of knowing which email messages came from one's wife or husband for the marital privilege, from a psychologist for the psychotherapist privilege, from their attorney. And recently, actually, the Northern District of California had a situation in which somebody was they wanted to get access to email stored by Google, and in that case, they issued an order to the account holder to provide that information, but provided that first it could be reviewed by their attorney, and they could assert any privileges that they may be entitled. Turning to exhaustion, the constitutional standard is not reasonable efforts. It is the exhaustion of all alternative sources of information. Now, there actually is no record, nothing in the record, to show that Apple looked at network logs. There's two things of pertinent to that in the record. One is the Zonnick Declaration, paragraph 20, which is regarding checking the logs of a secure server, whether someone had accessed the file. And in paragraph 9 of the Ortiz Declaration, a reference to searching the email servers. But there is no forensic analysis of the office computers used by the employees at issue. There's no forensic analysis of the firewall or other networking devices that protects Apple from communications to the outside world back and forth.
This is something that directs you to the fourth element of Mitchell, and if you could tell me what you think about quoting from the case. When the information relates to matters of great public importance and when the risk of harm to the source is a substantial one, the court may refuse to require disclosure. Is that test met in this case?
Well, in this,
that element of the test.
I believe that goes in favor of our client. In this case, they're reporting newsworthy information, information that if it had been overheard at a cafe, if it had been released by Apple, would clearly have been news in the business sections of newspapers around the world. This is information that is important to the public, and freedom of discussion must embrace all issues in which the public has an interest. The public may, in fact, be more interested in this information than they would about some nuances of foreign policy. And such.
Well, in fact, the stock market reacts quite violently to these sorts of releases as to a new product coming out, possibly impacting the stock. So I presume that would clearly be an issue of public interest. And if it's not focused on just the ordinary individual who's interested in this stuff.
Indeed you are. Both the stockholders and the consumers would have an interest in this, a legitimate one. Press is also important to place this in perspective. By subpoenaing the ISPs, Apple is trying to do an end run around the protections of the California Shield, the Shield being the particular reporter's shield that protects reporters from a judgment of contempt.
I thought their briefs were saying these are not reporters in the traditional sense, and I couldn't quite understand. Maybe you understood what it is. What's the distinction here?
I actually would say that there is no distinction, that these are reporters that are covered by Article 2B of the California Constitution, and that constitutional provision is very broad. It lists out reporters and publishers, but it also mentions other persons connected with a very broad provision that goes beyond merely editors and publishers. But indeed, they are editors and publishers, as shown by the declarations of Professor and Ben Gilmore, but O'Grady is the editor-in-chief of a publication. He writes stories. He edits other stories. There's a staff of 9 other reporters. He's been publishing daily news for 10 years. Likewise, with the Apple Insider news site, has been in operation for many, many years, publishing news stories just like any reporter that would be protected under the California Shield Law.
I thought I recall Mr. Riley arguing that that only has a bearing on contempt cases.
We don't have
a contempt case here.
We do not have a contempt case here. And what I'm trying to point out is the end run that's going on. So that trying to deny them the opportunity to refuse to disclose and then have a court adjudicate whether they were or were not entitled to the shield, by going to the ISP, Apple is attempting to rob them of even the opportunity to present that shield, to set up a situation so that they could refuse.
You have 2 minutes left.
Thank you very much. Then I want to turn for a second, first of all, to 2019-210, the provision formerly known as 2019-D, and point to where Apple has tried to identify its trade secrets. They say there is no non-trade secret information about Asteroid. That is not identifying the trade secret with any particularity. And then we have a balance between trade secrecy and the First Amendment and the Liberty of Speech Clause of the California Constitution, which is broader than the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. The Constitution always has to trump. And you can look at some examples of whether, when other courts have faced the question of whether a particular statute should trump the constitutional protections. In Baker v. F&F Investment, the court was dealing with federal civil rights and alleged discrimination. In that case, they found they could not pick and choose amongst various statutes and find that one had triumphed over all others. In Inway Petroleum Products litigation, they were dealing with federal antitrust laws, also very important public policy supporting the antitrust laws. But again, the court found that, that even though there are important public policies behind the antitrust laws, that could not trump the protections under the First Amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Riley? Mr. Riley, on this thing that I raised about all trade secrets are not equal, but would there be a difference in the trade secret involved in the Avanti case and the trade secret here?
Your Honor, in both cases, they were technical specifications. Certainly the amount of trade secret material at issue in Avanti was greater.
Were there manufacturing drawings here?
In this case, there were drawings of the appearance of the product and
the outside of the box.
And the technical specifications of what's inside the box. In addition, the confidential slide set, which was stolen, contains even more material about what's inside of the box.
But that wasn't published.
That was not disseminated. Some of it was disseminated. Others was not were not disseminated. But a very substantial amount was disseminated. I'd like to, if I may, turn to the Stored Communications Act, because I think we're treading on extremely dangerous ground here. Our position is not that Congress did not forbid the disclosure of communications. What Congress did not do is foreclose the courts of this country, all 50 states, from applying.
Asking us to look into that act and not look for an express provision that says civil subpoenas are okay. For example, it does have a number of very specific items in there. You're not asking us to do that. You're just saying that the effect, the implication, the context of the act means that a civil subpoena would be okay.
Absolutely, as well as the express defenses that we've discussed.
Well, why would we be applying something that Congress hasn't clearly enunciated in the statute? That's basically rewriting it to allow your civil subpoena to be part of the exception.
No, not at all, Your Honor. If Congress intends to override the judicially established and legislatively established rules governing civil discovery, both at the congressional level for federal discovery as well as the state level, they must do so expressly, or else they're going to run right smack into principles of federalism.
What is it you want us to imply then?
No, what we do is we treat this Stored Communications Act the same way that we do other acts that create privacy rights.
But there's no provision in it that says you have a right to a civil subpoena.
Section 2707 says you can make a disclosure based on a court order or statutory authorization. And the way that that kind of language has been interpreted uniformly
is permitting subpoenas. Well, of course, if there's child pornography, well, there's exceptions that clearly would permit disclosure, but we're talking about a case in which you don't even have a defendant suit. So, do you understand what I'm saying?
And that often is the case with child pornography. You don't know who is disseminating.
What's the difference that I'm talking about a standard civil dispute. Why should the email system be treated any differently than a telephone? I mean, the very reason for Congress's passing this act was to make sure that you had access, people would be comfortable using the email, not say, the minute I go on email, I have a possibility the email company to disclose everything I have on there. The Congress felt that this would be a disaster for the developing technology. Because you're saying, well, you should be able to go ahead and subpoena anyway for my civil suit, whereas you can't subpoena anything from the telephone company except the fact that there was a phone number used, which means nothing about what the content of the conversation was.
Your Honor, that last part of your question is not correct. There are cases that permit parties in civil discovery to discover the content of telephone communications, and we've cited two of those cases for you. In re motion to unseal electronic surveillance evidence, Eighth Circuit case.
Different. I mean, you know, the fact that the government is tapping a phone, of course. I mean, that's a different story. I'm talking about the standard operation. If I were working at Apple, pick up a phone and say, there are three knobs on this new thing that we're coming out with, and that's published, you wouldn't be able to find out what I said.
If there was a...
But if I email this information, you're saying you have a right to find out what is on that email. You don't have that right.
Your Honor, we do have that right under the SCA, just as we do, for example, the Telecommunications Act. This is the case called ICG. In that case, it was a civil fight, and one party wanted to discover not only the identity of customers, but the content of their communications. The Telecommunications Act, much like HIPAA and other acts, establish broad privacy rights, very broad privacy rights. And the court in that case said that those privacy rights are also have to be balanced against civil litigants' rights to discovery.
So is it a penumbral emanation of the Stored Communications Act?
Maybe an emanation penumbra. I mean, it is in fact...
But that's your claim, is it not?
Absolutely.
Yes.
I have a privacy right in my tax information. I have a privacy right in my health
information.
Yeah,
but that's explicit.
And those are explicit. But those rights often give way to civil discovery. Often give way to civil discovery. In the Telecommunications Act, the court ordered the contents of telecommunications to be disclosed.
What was at stake there?
The identity and content of conversations of customers of the telephone network. Because there was a dispute about who was stealing information with regard to subscribers.
And was it a civil action or criminal action?
It was a civil action. And what the court said was, thus, although Congress may have the power to impose a ban on discovery for certain matters, there should be a clear expression of congressional intent before relevant information essential to the fair resolution of a lawsuit, civil lawsuit, will be deemed absolutely and categorically exempt from discovery and not subject to the powers of the court under Rule 26. And the electronic surveillance evidence was also a civil action. And in that case, the court...
But this is different. All you want here... I mean, I understand what the court said in that case. But here, all you want is the name of the snitch, basically. That's what this case is all about. So you're saying that you have a right to invade the privacy of the email system to basically trump the protections of the First Amendment and the Shield Law in order to get what? Some complicated information about what's going on? No. Just to find out who in your organization, not yours, but your client's organization, is acting inappropriately by giving information about the latest item that's going to be shown in Las Vegas. That's what we're talking about.
We're talking about an individual who acted not only inappropriately, inappropriately, but criminally to do this. And this
well,
is
why... You shouldn't hire people that you think are criminal. You can't... The cases you're citing have nothing to do with this case that's before us. Nothing.
Your Honor,
the information that you want to seek put a huge hole in the Communications Act in order to seek the name of an individual that has been acting out by giving information against your client. I mean, come on.
Your Honor, it would be a profound shift in the approach that courts have taken to take an act like the SCA.
Well, there's two cases that you cite nationally, and they're talking about some detailed information about disclosing information about customers who and all of that. We're talking about a case here involving who is this person at Apple that gave this information. That's a whole different world.
Your Honor, it could be an employee or it could be a third party. This could be electronic espionage. Again, given the nature of our investigation, we were not able to designate an individual.
Well, you gave 25 people or whatever knew about this process, and you obviously have a computer. You can keep track of what's going out of your system. You have a right to do that out of the corporate headquarters. Check that out. put them on the, give them a lie detector test. I mean, you know, what?
Your Honor, I think lie detector tests would run afoul of other corporate policies and personal policy policies.
Well, you know what? If you've got a product that you think is that hot an item that's going to really affect your corporate well-being, then maybe you should set aside your reluctance to give lie detector tests to people who you think might have done something to destroy the integrity of your company. I mean, that's a decision you have to make.
But
you're not here to be the super personnel committee for your company.
Indeed, you're not. But underlying the petitioner's position is a double standard.
You have a minute left, Mr.
Thank
Riley.
You. Is a double standard which the courts have rejected. The United States Supreme Court in Brandsburg was very clear. The First Amendment is not a shield to either the journalist or the journalist's source to engage in illegal activity. And the petitioners in this case are arguing that, in fact, it should be a shield to illegal and reprehensible conduct. And every court that has looked at that has found it squarely is not such a shield.
Mr. Riley, I have just one question. That's a change of subject, but your underlying complaint, you have no defendants there except DOE defendants.
That is correct.
And what is the prayer in that underlying complaint?
Your Honor, we're seeking both damages and injunctive relief.
Damages against whom?
The individuals who misappropriated and illegally disseminated this confidential trade secret information.
Who presumably would be your Apple's employees?
It could be an Apple employer, they could be a third party, because again, knowing dissemination of trade secrets is both a crime and a civil offense.
But you're not, the complaint did not contemplate damages against Grady or journalists or whatever we're talking about.
If they have a good faith defense, in other words, if they can claim that they didn't know it was trade secrets, they're not going to be subject to either prosecution or civil remedy. If they knew that it was a trade secret, the law provides Apple with a remedy against them for the knowing dissemination of trade secrets.
Mr. Riley, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Epsilon, you have 5 minutes. You don't have to take it all.
Okay, just a couple of points then to close out. First, in its briefing, Apple has admitted, as it must, that the Stored Communications Act has specific provisions which delineate when a subpoena may be used in the case of criminal activities, in the case of government accessing it. So it is ironic that they would use their unsupported intimations of criminal activities to suggest there should be a variance from the Stored Communication Act civil provisions. And indeed, I also point this court to New York Times versus Gonzalez case, which dealt with finding the phone logs of reporters in order to identify the sources which they had spoken to over the phone. Turning for a second to exhaustion and the value of the trade secret, one of the advantages of the exhaustion test and what makes it useful in determining when the qualified privilege should be applied is it ensures that if it truly is the crown jewels, that this is the kind of trade secret that is extraordinarily important, then a company will exhaust, that they will take that extra effort to look at all available sources of information, look at the network logs, take the depositions of the employees under oath with the added incentive of the penalty of perjury, so that we know that reporters are not being asked to be the investigative arms of litigants lightly, that only in the most extreme of circumstances where there is no other reasonable alternative and they are the last resort. It's worth noting in this case that there was no other discovery. In all the cases dealing with exhaustion, there has been some form of discovery. In this case, the only discovery that has been served is to the reporters. It is not the last resort, but the first resort. And it is vital to ensure that journalists are not forced A, to choose between using the tools of the modern trade and taking advantage of third-party service providers and being able to assert their constitutional privilege, that these subpoenas do not threaten to turn journalists into the investigative arms of litigants, and that a burden is not placed upon the free flow of information from the press to the public based upon information that is both newsworthy and timely information. Any questions?
No, thank you. We enjoyed this. Thank you for your patience. And the matter will stand submitted. We'll be adjourned.